Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to San Francisco City Insider, the San Francisco Chronicle podcast on the people and politics making headlines in the city by the bay. I'm Chronicle columnist Heather Knight, and I'm here today with Jonathan Moscone. He's the chief producer of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which has a big weekend coming up. He's also the son of the late San Francisco mayor, George Moscone, and he's reminiscing about what it was like growing up with such a famous dad and that horrible day he learned his father had been assassinated along with Supervisor Harvey Milk. I'll be right back with Jonathan Moscone. Jonathan Moscone, thank you for joining me today.
Good to be here.
You are the chief producer of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and you have a big weekend coming up. It's the YBCA 100 Summit, which honors those on the 2019 YBCA 100 list, which you described as the gifted artists, leaders, activists, thinkers, movers, and dreamers who are using their creative and political power to enact change. Who are some of the people on that list that you're especially excited about highlighting?
Oh, my gosh. Well, this is the first year we've had the plurality of our list is local.
Uh-huh.
And that was intentional on our part to look inside of the Bay Area and see all the people who are doing what they do here. People like June Grant, who is one of 400 architects in this country who mm-hmm. are an African-American woman. That is amazing to that number. But what she's doing to use her design firm and architecture firm to develop neighborhoods with a focus on equity and inclusion is deeply inspiring. And she's going to be speaking. And we have Rita Moreno,
yes,
who actually is local. She lives in Berkeley. And I've always been in massive crush on Rita, and I saw her speak a year ago in D.C. on Arts Advocacy Day, and she just gets up there and she just lays it out there.
She's a powerhouse, huh?
She's a powerhouse. And Adrienne Marie Brown, who's a writer and a social justice activist, and she's called a pleasure activist. In fact, she has a book called Pleasure Activism.
What is that?
An emergent strategy is how to find joy in your activism, how to identify your joyful self in when you're trying to change the world, because it's a brutal and a lot of work.
Yeah.
So those are some of the people who I'm really thrilled about. Marvin K. White, who is at Glide Memorial Church, and he is going to give us a blessing at the end of the day. And he's one of the most inspiring people. He did a homily at Grace Cathedral last year as part of an event we did about what it means to be gay. And it was a homily. It was like, you got up. It was almost Pentecost. You got up and you just cheered at the end. So these are people who are activating their creativity from every angle, whether they are artists or whether they're architects or like Amanda Wynn, who runs RISE, which is an organization that teaches communities how to enact legislative change.
Mm-hmm.
These people are getting stuff done.
Yeah.
It's one thing to be critical. It's another thing to try to get things done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it sounds like an inspiring weekend.
Yeah.
And you've been at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts since 2015 and previously served as the artistic director for California Shakespeare Theater. What is it like to work in and promote the arts these days in a city that is increasingly losing its artists because nobody can afford to live here?
It is the reason I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the arts were ever safe as an industry, but they were certainly safer than they have been now. And the real threat of loss of not just the individual artists, but what they do, which is imagine solutions for us. What they do and where they come from and the aspirations they enact through their work that provide another narrative for our city, for our Bay Area, that isn't the base narrative of what, you know, when we see things that are happening on the street and we just want them gone and we just want this fixed and we want that changed. Artists have a capacity to think about how to do that with a deeper question and a way of doing that creatively and inspirationally that if they're deployed inside of the right conversations that aren't necessarily in a room where they're just making a beautiful piece of art, they are destined to be some of the most important and powerful people, the change agents that we need in a city that is so beautiful and so complicated and so naughty. And I mean with a K-N-O-T-T-Y, naughty.
It's the other naughty, too.
And it is that. But we need these people. And so the job that I have now is dedicated to finding ways to center them in the issues that are intractable in our city in the Bay Area. And hopefully that inspires more around the country.
And do you think San Francisco still values the arts and theater as much as ever, or do you think residents have different priorities in today's booming economy and are kind of moving away from supporting the arts?
Well, we ran a campaign to restore the relationship between the hotel tax, which began in 1961 to support arts funding in San Francisco and gradually was eroded and folded into the general fund of San Francisco because indeed – in tougher times, the city needed the money. And while the priorities were set differently by the city at the time, we as artists and arts organizations felt that we needed to put this to the vote of the people and see if we could reconnect the tax to the arts. And so we polled, and we polled at 67%, and we needed to make at least 67% of the vote. And we won on election night in November with 75% of the vote. So that, to me, the direct answer to your question is 75% of people agreed with us.
So I think like 75% of San Franciscans don't agree on anything. So
in fact, nothing.
Yeah.
Right. So they did. And I think that was proof. You know, I listened to Barney Frank, who was a, you know, one of my idols in Congress, you know, first openly gay serving congressman. And he, the answer to a question, I was at an event and someone said, how do you know that? And he said, that's what the polls say. And that's what, so when people say that, that's what the people want.
Yeah.
And so the answer to that question is, yeah, that's what they wanted.
Yeah. That's cool.
And let's be clear, the mayor was behind it. The supervisors were behind it. So we weren't in contrast to the current administration. So fortunately, we weren't necessarily 75% of the city going against the city hall.
Yeah.
We were all working together.
Yeah, that's good and rare.
That's right. Good and rare. Let's hold on to these moments. Yeah.
You are, of course, practically San Francisco royalty with the last name Moscone. Your dad was George Moscone, who was a supervisor when you were born. I've been reading up on you. And he later became state senator and mayor. And I read that you credit him with sparking your love of theater. Can you tell me more about that?
He loved theater.
Did he?
He was he loved theater. He loved movies. He loved opera. And he took me to theater. He took us to movies. I remember the first R-rated movie we saw. We went to the House of
Shield.
What
was it?
We saw The Longest Yard.
Oh.
With Burt Reynolds. And I don't know, it was a special day. He took me out in his little Alfa Romeo. He took me for a drink. He gave me a drink. I was like 13 at the time. I didn't really drink it, but he was so proud of that. And when I went to SI, St. Ignatius, where he had gone to school, my brother went to school, and all my nieces and nephews went to school, I joined the theater right off the bat. You know, I was not a sports geek. Sports geek. I love that. I just coined a new phrase. Down with the sports geeks. I got into theater, and I came home, and he couldn't have been prouder. You know, and to see that, you know, he in some ways he had a kind of great Santini quality. He was hyper competitive. He was great at sports. But the last thing he did was make me feel anything but amazing for being an actor. So I think it was a combination of his support and the fact that as my dad and as a boy coming into his adolescence, I was fully accepted. I never questioned any of it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up with such a well-known father?
Well, it was hard to compare it though I did often compare it to a lot of my friends' parents who I thought were – because they were home every day. Mm-hmm. You know, when my dad was in Senate, he was away for a lot of the – in fact, most of the week, mm-hmm. except for on the recesses. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he was home on weekends, and sometimes he had to stay up in Sacramento or travel down to L.A. So he was like a special guest mm-hmm. in my life and mm-hmm. scary mm-hmm. in that regard. And fabulous and kind of mythic in dadness. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a very sort of masculine, strong, good-looking, just confident man. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of hard to have as a kind of in and out of my life. But he always gave us a good time. Mm-hmm. We always did great things with him. My mom was sort of stuck with the dirty work, so I think you asked her.
Raising the kids,
yeah. She had to be all the cops in the house. And then when he became mayor, he was home. Mm-hmm. He was home every day. After school, mm-hmm. I would go to City Hall. Mm-hmm. I would bring my backpack to the back room. I'd take my I'd do homework back there, or I'd go to the main library and do my homework. It was kind of awesome.
It was awesome.
Really both super special mm-hmm. and kind of – normal mm. at that point. And mm-hmm. and I think what the suckiest part mm-hmm. for my time in life at that point was that was the shortest lived relationship, mm. part of the relationship I had.
Yeah.
Because that ended 2 years in.
Just 2 years.
Yeah.
Did you spend a lot of time at City Hall in those 2 years?
Oh, yeah. I was kind of annoying. I'm sure I probably still am when I show up at City Hall. But yeah, I loved it. It was just so much fun.
Yeah. And it's such a gorgeous building.
It was, yeah. And he had this really cool desk. That was so weird. It was a desk that was someone had given him, or I don't know, given the city, and it would push a button and it would rise up mm-hmm. so he could give speeches from it. It had a television in it, in a console, and it had a phone. It was like this early James Bondy
wow.
kind of thing. And it sat just living in our basement after he died mm. and just fell apart.
Do you still have it?
No.
It's long gone.
My mother hated it. I was like, I don't like that desk. It's not classic. It's not what a mayor should have.
But
anyway, it was cool. I remember playing around a lot.
That is cool.
Yeah.
And so you were 14 when he died, mm-hmm. assassinated along with Supervisor Harvey Milk by Dan White. That was nearly 41 years ago next month. Mm-hmm. Does it seem like that long? And what do you remember about that day?
I think because we're getting towards the anniversary of his death, which is a couple of days around his birthday.
Oh. How old would he have been next month?
Oh, gosh. He died when he was 48, so 41 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that would be 89.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. None 89 or 90, I think, by that point.
Yeah.
Okay. What happens is you get into a kind of – our family kind of gets into a bit of a funk.
Mm.
And we, for many years, we didn't really understand why we were bickering mm-hmm. with each other. And it mm-hmm. was just because it just was like this weird undertow
mm-hmm.
that we wouldn't, and we weren't really, we're not a super talkative family around it. Like, mm-hmm. how do you feel about mm-hmm. it? It's
yeah.
never, because the answer is never like, oh, I feel good. So I think I feel it more right now. So mm-hmm. it kind of comes and goes in waves.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think about him right now, this month, I don't know, past couple of weeks, I'm thinking about him so much,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know why,
mm-hmm.
but I am.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels very, very recent
mm-hmm.
To me. I remember everything mm-hmm. about that day, although I think maybe what I remember is about 10 days squashed into one
mm-hmm.
or 1 day's into 10. I can't mm-hmm. remember the days themselves because I don't remember sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anyone sleeping. We were never alone. We were kind of on watch.
Mm-hmm.
We had family, friends, police. Everybody was just there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was unfathomable. And kind of living through the unfathomable is just not something you forget, though and it makes you a little just like low-level depressed.
Yeah, yeah.
But it also never has kept any of us in our family, certainly not me, from being engaged
mm-hmm.
in the world. And I love the city too much to check out of it.
Yeah. For listeners who were born after your father died, what would you want them to know about him?
Oh, man. Well, a lot of things. I think many things that people don't know about him surround his time as a legislator in the Senate. I mean, anyone who knows politics enough to see the difference here would completely understand that when you're in a legislative body, you can get much more done than when you're an executive body. And he passed so many of the first legislations in this country, for gay rights. Bill in this country was passed by my father, and the school lunch program was passed by my father. There were so many things that he did which were firsts. He was the first to do a the first form of legalizing marijuana. I think he got it down to like anything below an ounce. George Miller, the former congressman, has a great story about that. You should ask him. He has to tell it. It's so good because he was his chief of staff. And he was able to get it to an ounce, like not counting buds or something, or not counting seeds. So I guess that's what they did. I guess they liked to smoke in the back then, my dad and George. And then I think that those things are kind of important because they were instigators of real, you know, policy change. But the big sort of grander policy change that he enacted in San Francisco in his brief time is is who was in the building, who were on commissions, who were appointed, who were who ultimately ran for supervisor, who then ultimately became mayor. And you look at City Hall now, and I don't know if without my dad it wouldn't have happened, but he did it, and he did it really early.
Diversified.
Yeah, and I think most people don't really know. I think people over a certain age know this, but before that, the power structure of San Francisco was Democrat in name only. It was very much kind of this religious Democrats, these kind of rich business Democrats.
So there
all men. Yeah, they all look. If you look at all those bronze statues, they all look alike. They all look like, yeah, they could be Republican. They could be anybody. They just. But they were, and it just – it was a top-down city, fully top-down city. And my dad was much less top-down of a man as a legislator. You know, Heather, I'll get this to you because it's such an amazing speech. I was given this speech, the one that my dad gave to announce that he was running for mayor. And this was in December of 1974. And there's a paragraph at the beginning, and he says, "This city does not belong to white men. This city belongs to people of God." I mean, he named it in 74.
Wow.
And he said, and then he said things like, you know, going to work on the Muni should be a joy. And I was like, wow, that was then.
Did he take Muni to work?
He did until no. when he became mayor, he was so excited. He didn't want to have – okay, this may be apocryphal, but I do like to tell this story as if it isn't. But, you know, he really – he was a street kid. He grew up in San Francisco, and he would wake up every morning when he was running for mayor and ride from the beginning of Muni to the end, and he would just shake hands. So man knew the streets of San Francisco. And so when he said – when he became mayor, he's like, "I'm not going to get a limo. I'm not going to have a driver." And he bought himself a little sports car. And then John Barbagelata, whom he had beaten, tried to recall him and created a recount. And my dad got so pissed. And so he won resoundingly this recount, my dad. And John Barbagelata just left politics. And I think very soon after, my dad got a driver. It's like, I'm the effing mayor. I'm mayor.
I need a driver.
And I kind of was like, all right. Yeah. I'm not even sure that story is true, but I've kind of built it up as to let's say it is. Yeah.
I like it. Does San Francisco seem like a totally different place from when you were a kid, or are there still parts of it that are familiar to you?
Yeah. Yes and yes. It is very, very different in some ways that I think we all hyper-focus on. Right. If you were to really look around along Mission Street or even to parts of downtown or south of Market, you would see a city that didn't exist before. I grew up on the west side.
Neighborhood?
We grew up on Mount Davidson, just below the cross. And then when my dad was elected, we moved to St. Francis Wood. Went to high school down there. Went to grammar school at the top of Knob Hill. It's Notre Dame de Victoire. But most of our lives was on the west side. And you see the west side, and that doesn't – it's very, very much the same.
Yeah.
And even though the stores on West Portal are slightly different, it's pretty much West Portal.
Pretty similar, yeah.
Yeah. So – and I've started to ride my bike more. My husband is an inveterate bike rider. And so when you ride the bike, mm-hmm. you ride your bicycle, you actually see the city in the same way you did when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of see it from this – you're like, oh, that's what that stoop looked like. That looked like yeah. that too. So we all know how much it has changed. Mm-hmm. I think that narrative has been really deeply, deeply ingrained. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you did when you did the 49 mile.
Yeah.
I mean, you heard stories. Uh-huh. It's not quite that way. It's uh-huh. a much more complex narrative than I think has been shared – has been told internally mostly mm-hmm. and certainly from an external point of view, mm-hmm. Not to diminish the inequity.
Right.
But it still is San Francisco.
A lot of the neighborhoods are very similar to.
Yeah, how they kind
been.
Of. Some of them really are. Yeah,
except
some
for
of them
who
are,
can afford to live there. But
that,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we all know that, and that's not that's nothing. That's nothing to diminish.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's like that great movie. You know, the Last Black Man in San Francisco mm-hmm. that
yeah,
Joe Talbot
that
did. That's such a great. Oh my gosh, it's such a great movie. But at the end, he's riding the bus, and there's mm-hmm. those two young women,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, "I hate San Francisco. I hate San Francisco." And he just looks up and he says, "Where are you from?" And they said, "Where are they from? How long have you lived? Do you like San Francisco?" I don't know. It's like, well, I'm from San Francisco, and I love San Francisco, which means I can hate San Francisco.
Yeah.
But if you don't love San Francisco, you can't hate San Francisco.
Right.
And I was like, I went, amen. Like I was like, in the audience, that was totally true. That's exactly true. So there are times when I hate San Francisco. It's because I love it.
Yeah. I feel like it's the same way with your family. Like you can talk badly about a relative, but nobody else can.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
What do you think your dad would make of San Francisco circa 2019?
I think – some of the stories I knew about him and what I understand about him, certainly around, say, Yerba Buena,
mm-hmm.
was that he was certainly not someone who was going to stand up against development, but he was going to make sure that the right people were in the room to inform the development of the
mm-hmm.
city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what enabled Yerba Buena to move forward. And so I don't think San Francisco would have not developed – had my dad had, mm-hmm. you know, six more years. But I think he would have established more of a precedent and a more of a policy of who was included
mm-hmm.
in the decision-making process about how neighborhoods were developed. And I think that would be the part that if he were not able to have made that happen,
mm-hmm.
I think he would have bemoaned that.
Mm.
Because I think that we kind of lost sight of that
mm-hmm.
in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think it just continued.
Yeah.
That's what I believe.
Well, you've survived my serious questions.
Oh, my gosh. Did I do okay?
Very well.
You know, just so I could bring it back to the summit for a second, because uh-huh. I think it's important. You know, one of the things that's important for me about this summit and this list is, and why it's focused on local is because, Heather, about mm-hmm. the narrative that I think is so just being pounded mm-hmm. in many, many ways. In conversations around the city and nationally about, you know, tech versus bad tech, San mm-hmm. Francisco is not, you know, all these things. And there is truth in some of that,
mm-hmm.
but there is so much diversity and there's mm-hmm. so much creativity and there's so many people doing so many amazing things
yeah.
that we have to sometimes stand up and tell that story.
Oh, for sure.
Not to erase the other story, but to tell more than one narrative.
Yeah.
And so that's what this is. That's what drives me in this mm-hmm. whole summit. This is why I love this day. And
mm-hmm.
I've become so it has become so deep for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that. And now it's time for the lightning round.
Lightning round. All right.
Where is your favorite place in San Francisco to get a burrito?
I have keto. I don't eat burritos. Oh, my gosh. I don't have one.
Okay.
Oh no, the place, I don't even know the name of it, but it's at the bottom of Castro Street at 18th. And I go in there and they make it for me without anything but like, it's like chicken and salsa. And then
you won't ever eat tortillas. You were telling us earlier that you took your tortilla off your breakfast burrito this
morning. And it was disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
you're just anti-tortilla?
I just have suddenly look in the mirror and see a normal-sized human being, and that's because of the keto diet. So I can't
okay.
quite give it up yet.
What's your favorite movie filmed in San Francisco?
It has to be What's Up, Doc.
Mm.
Because Madeline Kahn is so brilliant
mm-hmm.
in it.
Where do you like to go for a stiff drink?
My kitchen. yeah, I think I just answered that.
What's your favorite thing to drink in your kitchen?
My husband makes an excellent Bullet Rye Perfect Manhattan. The other place I like to drink is at my friend Robert Mailer Anderson's house, mm-hmm. and he makes the most excellent martinis, gin martinis. So I actually like my friend's houses and
nice.
My husband.
What was your first concert?
Oh, this is embarrassing. Christopher Cross. Yes. I just said it, everybody. Yeah. In case you were thinking I was irrelevant, I'll just double down on that one. At the Cow Palace.
Ooh. Yeah. What was the last book you read?
White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo.
What is your favorite depiction of politicians in movies or on TV?
Hmm. Oh, my God. Veep.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
100% Veep.
Yeah.
And right behind that would be The Candidate with Robert Redford.
Okay. What is your all-time favorite play?
The Seagull by Anton Chekhov.
Hmm. There are quite a few things named after your family in San Francisco, including an elementary school and, obviously, the huge convention center. Is it still weird to see your name on buildings, or are you used to it by now?
Yeah, well, I don't bad glide. This is I would really suck at – wait, don't tell me at the end. You know what I don't like? I love the George R. Moscone School because it's his name.
Mm-hmm.
The convention center is called Moscone. Mm-hmm. I don't like that because mm-hmm. it's just divorced from the person.
Mm.
So I have my most favorite is the school. My least favorite is the convention center.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, what is something you always make sure to squeeze into your busy day?
My dog and I always go to DeBose Park. My little teeny dog, Lucy, and I let her off the lead and I just hang out with everybody there. We don't really know each other's names, mm-hmm. but we all get to talk, and she runs around, and it's the thing that just keeps me from focusing on myself, uh-huh. and it just roots me in my evening.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for coming. It was really fun to talk to you.
It was fun, Heather. Thank you.
Thanks to Jonathan Moscone for being here today, to King Kaufman and Karen Creighton for producing this episode, and to you for listening. San Francisco City Insider is part of the San Francisco Chronicle podcast network. Audrey Cooper is the editor-in-chief. If you like this show, please subscribe and give us a quick review wherever you get your podcasts. Support San Francisco City Insider and a lot of great journalism with a print or digital subscription to the San Francisco Chronicle. Find out more at sfchronicle.com/subscribe.